The Tooleys, a couple of idiots, somewhere out in West Texas. What county, Bonnie? Mingo? Mingo County. Very rural. A great story, listen. These two thugs were robbing convenience stores and gas stations. Very sophisticated stuff. One night, something goes wrong and a young female clerk gets shot. Sawed-off shotgun. Really nasty. They catch the Tooley brothers because the boys forgot about all of the video cameras. The town is outraged. The police are strutting. The prosecutor is promising swift justice. Everybody wants a quick trial and quick execution. There's not much crime in Mingo County, and no jury there has ever sent a man to death row. Now, there are many ways to feel neglected in Texas, but living in a community that's been left out of the execution business is downright embarrassing. What do the kinfolks in Houston think? These Mingo people see their opportunity. They want blood. The boys refuse to plea bargain because the prosecutor insists on death. Why plead to death? So they try them together. Quick convictions and finally, death. On appeal, the court finds all manner of error. The prosecutor really butchered the case. The convictions are thrown out. The case is sent back for separate trials. Two trials, not one. Are you taking notes? No, I'm searching for some relevance here. It's a great story. That's all that matters. A year or so passes. The boys are tried separately. Two new guilty verdicts, two more trips to death row. The appeals court sees more problems. I mean, glaring problems. The prosecutor was a moron. Reversals, sent back for two new trials. The third time, one jury convicts the gunman of murder and he gets life. The other jury convicts the one who didn't fire the gun of murder and he gets death. Go figure. It's Texas. So, one brother is serving life, the other went to death row where he committed suicide a few months later. Somehow he got a razor and slashed himself. And your point is? Here's the point. From start to finish, the case cost Mingo County $3 million. They were forced to raise property taxes several times, and this led to an uprising. There were drastic budget cuts in schools, road maintenance, and health services. They closed their only library. The county was near bankruptcy for years. And all of it could have been prevented if the prosecutor had allowed the boys to plead guilty and take life without parole. I've heard that the death penalty is not that popular in Mingo County now. I was more interested in, from soup to nuts, it takes about $2 million to legally kill a man in Texas. Compare that with $30,000 it costs per year to keep one on death row. I've heard this before, Martha said, and indeed she had. Robbie never shied away from his soapbox, especially when the subject was the death penalty, one of his many favorites. But what the hell, we have plenty of money in Texas. Can we talk about Dante Drum's case? Oh, why not? The defense fund. You established a few years back a certified nonprofit governed by all relevant code sections set forth by the Internal Revenue Service, administered jointly by my office and Andrea Bolton, a younger sister of Dante Drum. Receipts so far total how much, Bonnie? $95,000. $95,000. And how much is on hand? Zero. That's what I figured. Would you like a breakdown of where the money went? Maybe. Where did it go? Litigation expenses, law firm expenses, expert witnesses, a few bucks to the family to travel back and forth to see Dante. Not exactly a high-powered nonprofit. All monies have been raised through the Internet. Frankly, we haven't had the time or manpower to pursue fundraising. Who are the donors? Mostly Brits and Europeans. The average donation is something like $20. $18.50, Bonnie said. It's very hard to raise money for a convicted murderer, regardless of his story. How much are you out of pocket? Martha asked. There was no rapid response. Bonnie, finally stumped, gave a slight shrug from the front seat. I don't know, Robbie said. If I had to guess, it would be at least $50,000, maybe $100,000. Maybe I should have spent more. Phones were buzzing throughout the van. Sammy at the office had a question for the boss. Christy Hines was talking to another psychiatrist. Aaron was listening to someone as he drove. The party began early with sweet potato biscuits straight from Reva's oven. She loved to cook them and eat them, and when Sean Fordyce admitted he'd never eaten one, she feigned disbelief. By the time he arrived with his hairdresser, makeup girl, appointment secretary, and publicist, all hustling around him, the home of Reva and Wallace Pike was crammed with neighbors and friends. The thick smell of fried country ham wafted out of the front door. Two long trucks were backed into the driveway, and even the crew members were chomping on biscuits. Fordyce, an Irish ass from Long Island, was slightly irritated by the crowd, but put on his game face and signed autographs. He was the star. These were his fans. They bought his books, watched his show, and gave him his ratings. He posed for a few photographs, ate a biscuit with ham, and seemed to like it. He was pudgy with a doughy face, not exactly the traditional looks of a star, but that didn't matter anymore. He wore dark suits and funky eyeglasses that made him appear far more intelligent than he acted. The set was in Reva's room. The large addition stuck to the rear of the house like a cancerous growth. Reva and Wallace were situated on a sofa, with colored blow-ups of Nicole as the backdrop. Wallace wore a tie and looked as if he'd just been ordered out of his bedroom, which in fact he had. Reva was heavily made up, her hair freshly colored and permed, and she wore her finest black dress. Fordyce sat in a chair close to them. He was tended to by his handlers, who sprayed his hair and powdered his forehead. The crew fussed with the lighting. Sound checks were done. Monitors were adjusted. The neighbors were packed in tight behind the cameras with stern instructions not to make a sound. The producer said, "Quiet, we're rolling." Close up on Fordyce as he welcomed his audience to another episode. He explained where he was, whom he was interviewing, and the basis of the crime, the confession, and the conviction. "If all goes as expected," he said gravely, "Mr. Drum will be executed the day after tomorrow." He introduced the mother and the stepfather and, of course, passed along his condolences for this tragedy. He thanked them for opening their home so that the world, through his cameras, could witness the suffering. He began with Nicole. "Tell us about her," he almost pleaded. Wallace made no effort to speak, something he would do throughout the interview. This was Reva's show. She was excited and overstimulated, and after just a few words began crying. But she had cried in public for so long that she could now chatter away while the tears flowed. She went on and on about her daughter. "Do you miss her?" Fordyce asked, one of his patented inane questions designed only to elicit more emotion. Reva gave it to him. He handed her the white handkerchief from his coat pocket, linen. The man oozed compassion. He finally got around to the execution, which was the thrust of his program. "Do you still plan to be there?" he asked, certain of the answer. "Oh, yes," she said, and Wallace managed to nod. "Why? What will it mean to you?" "It means so much," she said. The thought of revenge dried the tears. "This animal took my daughter's life. He deserves to die, and I want to be there, to stare him in the eyes when he takes his last breath." "Do you think he'll look at you?" "I doubt it. He's a coward. Any human who could do what he did to my precious little girl, I doubt he'll be man enough to look at me." "What about his last words? Do you want an apology?" "Yes, but I'm not expecting one. He has never taken responsibility for what he did." "He confessed." "Yes, but then he changed his mind, and he's denied it ever since. I expect he'll deny it when they strap him down and he says goodbye." "Anticipate for us, Reva. Tell us how you think you'll feel when he's pronounced dead." Just the thought made her smile, but she quickly caught herself. "Relief? Sadness? I don't know. It'll be the closing of another chapter in a long, sad story. But it won't be the end." Wallace frowned slightly upon learning this. "What's the final chapter here, Reva?" "When you lose a child, Sean, especially one taken in such a violent way, there is no end." "There is no end," he repeated somberly. then turned to the camera and with every effort at great drama said again, "There is no end." They took a quick break, moved some cameras, and added more spray to Fordyce's hair. And when they rolled again, he managed to get a few grunts from Wallace, stuff that wouldn't last 10 seconds in editing. The filming was over in less than an hour. Fordyce made a quick exit. He was also working on an execution in Florida. He made sure everyone knew there was a jet waiting to take him there. One of his camera crews would hang around Sloan for the next 2 days, hoping for violence. Fordyce would be in Huntsville on Thursday night, looking for drama, praying the execution would not be put off. His favorite part of his show was the post-execution interview, when he got the victim's family fresh from the prison. They were usually emotional wrecks, and he knew that Reva would light up the screen. Chapter 9. It took Dana almost 2 hours of persistent calling and cajoling to find the right deputy clerk willing to dig through the right record logs to determine that, yes, in fact, one Travis Boyette was arrested for drunk driving in Sloan, Texas, on January 6, 1999. After he was jailed, more serious charges were added. He had posted bond, then skipped town. Charges were dismissed and the file was closed when Mr. Boyette was arrested and sentenced to 10 years in prison in Kansas. The clerk explained the procedure in Sloan was to dispose of cases that would not or could not be pursued. There were no outstanding warrants on him, at least not in Sloan and Chester County. Keith, who'd been unable to sleep and brewed the first pot of coffee at 3:30 a.m., called Mr. Flack's office the first time at 7:30 a.m. He was not entirely certain what he would say to the lawyer if he got him on the phone, but he and Dana had decided they could not sit by and do nothing. When he was stiff-armed by Flack's receptionist, he called another lawyer. Matthew Burns was an assistant prosecutor and an active member of St. Mark's. He and Keith were the same age and had coached their son's t-ball teams together. Luckily, Burns was not in trial Tuesday morning, but was still quite busy in court with first appearances and other routine matters. Keith found the right courtroom, one of several in the courthouse, and from a seat in the back row watched the flow of justice. After an hour, he was fidgeting and ready to leave, though he wasn't sure where to go. Burns finished another appearance before the judge, stuffed his paperwork into his briefcase, and headed for the door. He nodded at Keith, who followed. They found a quiet place in the bustling corridors, a well-used wooden bench near a stairwell. "You look like hell," Burns began pleasantly. "Thanks. I'm not sure that's a nice way to greet your minister." "I couldn't sleep last night, Matthew. Not one minute." "Did you look at the website?" "Yes, for about 10 minutes at the office. I'd never heard of Drum, but then these cases tend to run together now. They're pretty routine down there." "Drum's innocent, Matthew," Keith said with a certainty that surprised his friend. "Well, that's what the website says, but he's not the first killer who claimed to be innocent." The two had rarely talked about the law or any issue related to the death penalty. Keith assumed that, as a prosecutor, Matthew supported it. "The killer is here in Topeka, Matthew. He was in church Sunday morning, probably in a pew not far from you and your family. You have my attention. He's just been paroled, spending 90 days at the halfway house, and he's dying of a brain tumor. He stopped by the office yesterday for counseling. He has a long history of sexual assaults. I've talked to him twice, and he's admitted, in confidence, of course. He raped and killed the girl. He knows where the body's buried. He doesn't want Drum to be executed, but he doesn't want to come forward either. He's a mess, Matthew, a real sick psycho who'll be dead himself in a few months." Matthew exhaled and shook his head as if he'd been slapped. "May I ask why you're in the middle of this?" "I don't know. I just am. I know the truth. The question is, how does one go about stopping an execution?" "Good God, Keith!" "Yes, I've talked to him too, and I'm still waiting on his guidance. But until it comes, I need some from you. I've called the defense lawyer's office in Texas, but that went nowhere." "Don't you have to keep these matters in confidence?" "Yes, and I will. But what if the murderer decides to come clean, to tell the truth, to try to save this man from being executed? What then? How do we go about it? We? Oh, not so fast, buddy. Help me here, Matthew. I don't understand the law. I've read the website until I'm cross-eyed, and the more I read, the more confused I become. How do you convict a man of murder when there's no dead body? How do you believe a confession that was so obviously coerced by the police? Why are jailhouse snitches allowed to testify in return for lighter sentences? How can a black defendant get an all-white jury? How can the jurors be so blind? Where are the appellate courts? I have a long list of questions. And I can't answer all of them, Keith. Seems, though, that the only important one is the first. How do you stop the execution? I'm asking you, pal. You're the lawyer. Okay. Let me think for a minute. You need some coffee, don't you? Yes, I've only had a gallon. They walked down a flight of stairs to a small canteen where they found a table in a corner. Keith bought the coffee, and when he sat down, Matthew said, "You gotta have the body. If your man can produce the body, then Drum's lawyers could probably get a stay from the courts. If not, the governor might delay the execution. I'm not sure how the mechanics work down there. Every state is different. Without the body, though, your man will sound like just another quack that shows up looking for attention. Keep in mind, Keith, that there will be the usual last-minute filings. These death penalty lawyers know how to play the system, and a lot of executions get delayed. You may have more time than you think. Texas is pretty efficient. Good point. 2 years ago, Drum came within a week of execution. Something clicked in a federal court filing, don't ask me what. I read it last night and I'm still confused. Anyway, according to the website, a last-minute miracle is unlikely now. Drum's had his miracle. His luck has run out. Finding the body is crucial. That's the only clear proof that your man is telling the truth. Do you know where it is? If you do, don't tell me. Just tell me if you know. No. He's told me the state, the nearby town, the general location. But he also said that he hid it so well he may have trouble finding it. Is it in Texas? Missouri. Matthew shook his head. He took a long drink and said, "What if this guy's just another lying con, Keith? I see a dozen a day. They lie about everything. They lie out of habit. They lie when the truth would be of far greater help to themselves. They lie on the witness stand and they lie to their own lawyers. And the longer they stay in prison, the more they lie." He has her class ring, Matthew. Wears it on a cheap little chain around his neck. He stalked the girl. He was obsessed with her. He showed me the ring. I held it and inspected it. "You're sure it's real?" "If you saw it, you would say it's real." Another long drink. Matthew glanced at his watch. "You gotta go?" 5 minutes. "Is this guy willing to go to Texas and proclaim the truth?" "I don't know. He says that if he leaves this jurisdiction, he violates his parole." "He's not lying about that. But if he's dying, why does he really care?" I asked him that. His answer was vague. Plus, the guy has no money, no way to get down there, he has zero credibility. No one will give him the time of day. "Why did you call the lawyer?" "Because I'm desperate, Matthew. I believe this guy, and I believe Drum's innocent. Maybe Drum's lawyer will know what to do, I don't know." There was a gap in the conversation. Matthew nodded and spoke to two other lawyers at the next table. He glanced at his watch again. "One last question," Keith said. "Just a hypothetical one. What if I convinced this guy to hustle down to Texas as soon as possible and start telling his story? You just said he can't get there." "Yes, but what if I take him?" "No, hell no, Keith. You'd be aiding in the violation of his parole agreement. Absolutely not." "How serious is that?" "I'm not sure, but it could get you embarrassed, maybe even defrocked for all you know. I doubt if you'd serve time, but it would be painful enough." "How is he supposed to get down there?" "I thought you said he hasn't decided to go. But if he does?" "Take it one step at a time, Keith." The third glance at his watch. "Look, I gotta run. Let's meet somewhere for a quick lunch and finish this conversation.
Good idea.
There's a deli down the street at the corner of 7th. It's called Eppie's. We can get a booth in the back and have a quiet chat.
I know the place.
See you at noon. The same ex-con with the permanent scowl was working the front desk at Anchor House. He was quite busy with a crossword and did not appreciate the interruption.
Boyette was not there, he said curtly.
Keith pressed gently.
Is he at work?
He's at the hospital. Took him in last night.
What happened?
Fits and seizures is all I know. Dude's really messed up in more ways than one.
Which hospital?
I didn't drive the ambulance. And with that, he returned to his crossword and the conversation was over. Keith found his patient on the third floor of St. Francis Hospital, in a semi-private room next to the window. A flimsy curtain separated the two beds. As a minister making his rounds, and a familiar face at that, Keith told the nurse that Mr. Boyette had visited his church and needed to see him. Nothing more was needed. Boyette was awake and had an IV tube taped to his left hand. He smiled when he saw Keith and offered a limp right hand for a quick shake.
Thanks for coming, Pastor, he said with a weak, scratchy voice.
How do you feel, Travis? 5 seconds passed. He raised his left hand slightly and said,
Some pretty good drugs. I feel better.
What happened? Keith asked, though he thought he knew. Boyette looked at the window, though he could see nothing but a gray sky. 10 seconds passed.
After you left, Pastor, I got real upset. The headaches hit hard and wouldn't go away. Then I blacked out. They brought me here. Said I was shaking and jerking.
I'm sorry, Travis.
Most of it's your fault, Pastor. You did it. You got me all stressed out.
I'm very sorry, but please remember that you came to see me, Travis. You wanted my help. You told me about Dante Drum and Nicole Yarber, two people I'd never heard of. You said what you said. I didn't initiate our contact.
True.
He closed his eyes. His breathing was heavy and labored. There was a long pause. Keith leaned over and almost in a whisper said,
Are you there, Travis?
Yes.
Then listen to me. I have a plan. You want to hear it?
Sure.
First, we make a video of you telling your story. You admit what you did to Nicole. You explain that Dante had nothing to do with her abduction and death. You tell everything, Travis. And you tell where she's buried. Give as much detail as possible so that, with some luck, they might be able to find her. We do the video now, here in the hospital. And once I have it, I'll zip it down to Texas, to Dante's lawyers, to the prosecutor, the judge, the police, the appeals courts, the governor, and every newspaper and television station down there so they will know. Everybody will know. I'll do this electronically so they'll have it in a matter of minutes. Then, for the second part of my plan, you give me the ring. I'll photograph it and send the pictures to all the folks I just mentioned, also by internet. I'll send the ring by overnight delivery to Dante's lawyers and they'll have the physical evidence. What about it, Travis? You can tell your story and never leave this hospital bed. The eyes never opened. Are you there, Travis?
A grunt.
It'll work, Travis. We can't waste any more time.
It is a waste of time.
What is there to lose? Just the life of an innocent man.
You called me a liar last night.
That's because you lied.
Did you find my arrest record in Sloan?
We did.
So I wasn't lying.
Not about that. And you're not lying about Dante Drum.
Thank you. I'm going to sleep now.
Come on, Travis. It'll take less than 15 minutes to make the video. I can even do it now with my cell phone if you want.
You're hurting my head again, Pastor. I feel a seizure.
You need to leave now, and please don't come back. Keith stood straight and took a deep breath.
To make sure things were clear, Boyette repeated himself, but much louder.
You need to leave, Pastor. And please don't come back.
In the rear of Eppie's, the two settled over large bowls of beef stew. Matthew pulled some notes out of a pocket and spoke with a mouthful. There's no code section directly on point, but you would probably be charged with obstruction of justice. Don't even think about taking that guy to Texas.
I just talked to our man.
He is our man? I didn't realize they'd been drafted. He's in the hospital. Had seizures last night. The tumor's quickly killing him. He's lost his desire to help the cause. He's a creep. A psychopath. Probably crazy before the tumor took over his brain.
Why did he come to church?
Probably to get out of the halfway house for a few hours. No, I shouldn't say that. I've seen real emotion from this guy, real guilt, and a fleeting desire to do what's right. Dana found one of his former parole officers in Arkansas. The officer talked a little and said that our man was a member of some white supremacist gang in prison. Dante Drum, of course, is black, and so I'm questioning how much sympathy is really there.
You're not eating, Matthew said as he took a bite.
I'm not hungry.
I have another idea.
You're not going to Texas. They would probably shoot you down there.
Okay, okay. Here's the idea. What if you call the lawyer for Dante Drum?
I couldn't get past the receptionist. I'm just a humble servant of the Lord.
But you're a lawyer, a prosecutor, and you speak their language.
And what might I say to him?
You could say that you have reason to believe that the real killer is here in Topeka.
Matthew chewed a mouthful and waited. He said,
Is that all?
Just like that. This lawyer gets a weird phone call from me. I say what I say, which isn't much, and that's supposed to give the lawyer new ammunition to file in court and stop the execution?
Am I right here, Keith?
I know you can be more persuasive than that.
Try this scenario. This creep is your typical pathological liar who's about to die, poor guy. And he decides to go out with a bang, decides to get one last shot of revenge at a system that's beating him up. He learns of this case in Texas, does his research, realizes that the body has never been found, and presto, he's got his story. He finds the website and becomes fluent in the facts, and now he's toying with you. Can you imagine the attention this guy would get? But his health won't cooperate. Leave it alone, Keith. He's probably a fake.
How would he hear about the case?
It's been in the newspapers.
How would he find the website?
You ever hear of Google?
He does not have access to computers. He's been at Lansing for the past 6 years. Prisoners do not have access to the internet. You should know that.
Can you imagine what would happen if they did?
Access plus all that idle time? No software in the world would be safe. He does not have access to a computer at the halfway house. This guy is 44 years old, Matthew, and has spent most of his adult life in prison. He's probably terrified of computers.
What about Drum's confession?
That doesn't bother you?
Of course it does, but according to his website...
Keith, come on! That website is run by his lawyers! Talk about slanted!
It's so one-sided it loses credibility.
And what about the ring?
It's a high school ring, one of a billion. Not exactly difficult to produce or replicate.
Keith's shoulders sagged and slumped, and he was suddenly very tired. He lacked the energy to keep arguing.
You need some sleep, my friend, Matthew said. And you need to forget this case.
Maybe you're right.
I think I am. And if the execution happens Thursday, don't beat yourself up. The odds are heavy that they have the right guy.
Spoken like a true prosecutor, who just happens to be a friend.
Chapter 10. On October 29th, 1999, 2 weeks after he was convicted, Dante Drum arrived on death row at the Ellis unit at the prison in Huntsville, a town of 35,000, about 90 miles north of downtown Houston. He was processed and issued the standard wardrobe of two sets of white shirts and pants, two white jumpsuits, four pairs of boxers, two white t-shirts, one pair of rubber shower shoes, one thin blanket, and one small pillow. He was also given a toothbrush, a tube of toothpaste, a plastic comb, and one roll of toilet paper. He was assigned to a small cell with one concrete bunk and a stainless steel toilet and sink. He became one of 452 male inmates on death row. There were 22 condemned women housed at another prison near Gatesville, Texas. Because he had no record of bad behavior in prison, he was classified as a level one. As such, he was allowed a few extra privileges. He could work up to 4 hours a day in the garment factory on death row. He could spend his exercise time in a yard with a few other inmates. He could shower once a day, alone, without supervision. He could participate in religious services, craft workshops, and educational programs. He could receive a maximum of $75 a month from the outside. He could purchase a television, a radio, writing supplies, and some food from the commissary. And he was allowed visitors twice a week. Those who violated the rules were demoted to level two, where the privileges were curtailed. The bad boys were reduced to level three, where all goodies were taken away. Though he had been in a county jail for almost a year, the shock of death row was overwhelming. The noise was relentless. Loud radios and televisions, the constant banter of the other inmates, the shouts from the guards, the whistling and gurgling from the old plumbing pipes, and the banging of the cell doors being opened and closed. In one letter to his mother, he wrote, "The racket never stops. Never. I try to ignore it, and for an hour or so I can. But then someone will scream or start singing badly, and a guard will yell and everybody will laugh. This goes on at all hours. The radios and televisions are turned off at 10 at night, and that's when the loudmouths start their foolishness. Living like an animal in a cage is bad enough, but the noise is driving me crazy." But he soon learned that he could endure the confinement and the rituals. He wasn't sure, though, if he could live without his family and friends. He missed his brothers and sister and father. The thought of being permanently separated from his mother was enough to make him weep. He cried for hours, always with his face down in the dark, and very quietly. Death row is a nightmare for serial killers and axe murderers. For an innocent man, it's a life of mental torture that the human spirit is not equipped to survive. His sentence of death took on a new meaning on November 16th when Desmond Jennings was executed for killing two people during a bad drug deal. The following day, John Lamb was executed for the murder of a traveling salesman, the day after Lamb had been paroled from prison. The next day, November 18th, Jose Gutierrez was executed for an armed robbery and murder he committed with his brother. The brother had been executed 5 years earlier. Jennings had been on death row for 4 years. Lamb, 16. Gutierrez, 10. A guard told Dante that the average stay on death row before execution was 10 years, which, he said proudly, was the shortest in the nation. Once again, Texas was number one. "But don't worry," the guard said. "It's the longest 10 years of your life, and of course the last." Ha ha. 3 weeks later, on December 8th, David Long was executed for the hatchet slayings of three women in a Dallas suburb. During his trial, Long told the jury he would kill again if not given the death penalty. The jury obliged. On December 9th, James Bethard was executed for another triple homicide. 5 days later, Robert Atworth was executed after only 3 years on death row. The following day, Sammy Felder was executed after a 23-year wait. After Felder's death, Dante wrote a letter to Robbie Flack in which he said, "Hey man, these dudes are serious around here. 7 killings in 4 weeks. Sammy was number 199 since they got the green light a few years back. He's also number 35 for this year, and they got 50 scheduled for next year. You gotta do something, man." Living conditions went from bad to worse. Administrators within the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, TDCJ, were in the process of moving death row from Huntsville to the Polunsky unit near the town of Livingston, 40 miles away. Though no official reason was given, The move came after an unsuccessful escape attempt by 5 condemned prisoners. 4 were captured within the prison. The 5th one was found floating in a river, cause of death unknown. Not long thereafter, the decision was made to tighten security and move the men to Polunsky. After 4 months in Huntsville, Dante was shackled and put on a bus with 20 others. At the new place, he was assigned to a cell that measured 6 feet by 10 feet. There were no windows. The door was solid metal with a small square opening so the guards could look in. Below it was a narrow slot for a food tray. The cell was enclosed, no bars to look through, no way to see another human. It was a cramped bunker of concrete and steel. The people who ran the prison decided that a 23-hour-a-day lockup was the proper way to control the prisoners and prevent escape and violence. Virtually all forms of inmate contact were eliminated. No work programs, religious services, group recreation, nothing that would allow human interaction. Televisions were banned. For 1 hour each day, Dante was led to a day room, a small enclosed indoor space not much larger than his cell. There, alone and watched by a guard, he was supposed to enjoy whatever recreation he could fabricate in his mind. Twice a week, weather permitting, he was taken outside to a small semi-grassy area known as the dog kennel. For an hour, he could look at the sky. Remarkably, he soon found himself longing for the non-stop noise he had so despised at Huntsville. After a month in Polunsky, in a letter to Robbie Flack, he wrote, "For 23 hours a day, I'm locked in this closet. The only time I speak to another person is when the guards bring food, or what they call food around here. So all I see is guards, not the kinds of people I'd choose. I'm surrounded by murderers, real murderers, and I'd rather talk to them than talk to the guards. Everything in here is designed to make life as bad as possible. Take mealtime. They feed us breakfast at 3 in the morning. Why? Nobody knows and nobody asks. They wake us up to feed us crap that most dogs would run from. Lunch is at 3 in the afternoon. Supper's at 10 at night. Cold eggs and white bread for breakfast, sometimes applesauce and pancakes. Peanut butter sandwiches for lunch. Sometimes bologna, bad bologna. Rubber chicken and instant mashed potatoes for supper. Some judge somewhere said that we're entitled to 2,200 calories a day. I'm sure you know this. And if they figure they're a little short, they just pile on some more white bread. It's always stale. Yesterday for lunch I got 5 slices of white bread, cold pork and beans, and a chunk of moldy cheddar cheese. Can we sue over the food? Probably already been done. But I can take the food. I can take the searches at all hours. I think I can handle anything, Robbie. But I'm not sure about the solitary confinement. Please do something." He became even more depressed and despondent, and was sleeping 12 hours a day. To fight boredom, he replayed every football game of his high school career. He pretended to be a radio announcer, calling the action, adding the color, always with the great Dante Drum as the star. He rattled off the names of his teammates, everyone but Joey Gamble, and gave fictitious names to his opponents. 12 games for his sophomore season, 13 for his junior, and whereas Marshall had beaten Sloan both years in the playoffs, Dante would have none of it in prison. The Sloan Warriors won those games, and advanced until they slaughtered Odessa Permian in the championship game, in Cowboys Stadium, in front of 75,000 fans. Dante was the most valuable player. Mr. Texas Football for both years, something that had never been done before. After the games, after he'd signed off his broadcasts, Dante wrote letters. His goal each day was to write at least 5. He read his Bible for hours and memorized verses of scripture. When Robbie filed another thick brief in another court, Dante read every word. And to prove it, he wrote long, grateful letters to his lawyer. But after a year in isolation, he began to fear that he was losing his memory. The scores of his old games slipped away. Names of teammates were forgotten. He couldn't rattle off the 27 books of the New Testament. He was lethargic and couldn't shake his depression. His mind was disintegrating. He was sleeping 16 hours a day and eating half the food they brought him. On March 14th, 2001, two events almost pushed him over the edge. The first was a letter from his mother. It was 3 pages long in the handwriting that he treasured. And after he read the first page, he quit. He could not finish reading the letter. He wanted to, and he knew that he should, but his eyes would not focus and his mind would not process her words. 2 hours later, he received the news that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals had affirmed his conviction. He wept for a long time, then stretched out on his bunk and stared at the ceiling in a semi-catatonic fog. He didn't move for hours. He refused lunch. In the last game of his junior year, in the playoffs against Marshall, his left hand had been stepped on by a 300-pound offensive tackle. 3 fingers were crushed and broken. The pain was instant and so intense that he almost passed out. A trainer taped the fingers together, and on the next series, Dante was back in the game. For almost the entire second half, he played like a wild man. The pain made him crazy. Between plays, he stood stoically and watched the offensive huddle, never once shaking his hand, never touching it, in no way acknowledging the pain that made his eyes water. From somewhere, he found the iron will and the incredible toughness to finish the game. Though he'd forgotten that score too, he vowed to reach down again, reach into the depths of his gut and the subconscious layers of a brain that was failing him, and find the will to stop his slide into insanity. He managed to pull himself off the bed. He fell to the floor and did 20 push-ups. Then he did sit-ups until his abdomen ached. He ran in place until he could no longer lift his feet. Squats, leg lifts, more push-ups and sit-ups. When he was covered in sweat, he sat down and made a schedule. At 5 each morning, he would begin a precise series of exercises and work non-stop for 60 minutes. At 6:30 a.m., he would write 2 letters. At 7 a.m., he would memorize a new verse of scripture, and so on. His goal was 1,000 push-ups and sit-ups a day. He would write 10 letters, and not just to his family and close friends. He would find some new pen pals. He would read at least 1 book a day. He would cut his sleep in half. He would begin a journal. These goals were printed neatly, labeled the routine, and stuck to the wall beside his metal mirror. Dante found the enthusiasm to stick to his regimen. He attacked it each morning. After a month, he was doing 1,200 push-ups and sit-ups a day, and the hard muscles felt good. The exercise brought the blood back to his brain. The reading and writing opened new worlds. A young girl in New Zealand wrote him a letter, and he shot one right back. Her name was Millie. She was 15 years old, and her parents approved the correspondence, but they monitored his letters. When she sent a small photo of herself, Dante fell in love. He was soon doing 2,000 push-ups and sit-ups, spurred on by the dream of one day meeting Millie. His journal was filled with graphic, erotic scenes of the couple as they traveled the world. She wrote him once a month, and for every letter she mailed, she got at least 3 in return. Roberta Drum made the decision not to tell Dante his father was dying of heart disease. And when, during one of her many routine visits, she told him his father was dead, Dante's fragile world began to crack again. The knowledge that his father had died before he could walk out of prison fully exonerated proved too much. He allowed himself to break his rigid routine. He skipped a day, then a second. He couldn't stop crying and trembling. Then Millie dropped him. Her letters arrived around the 15th of each month, every month for over 2 years, plus cards for his birthday and Christmas. For a reason Dante would never know, they stopped. He sent her letter after letter and received nothing in return. He accused the prison guards of tampering with his mail and even convinced Robbie to make some threats. Gradually, though, he accepted the fact that she was gone. He fell into a dark and long depression, with no interest in the routine. He began a hunger strike, didn't eat for 10 days, but gave it up when no one seemed to care. He went weeks with no exercise, no reading, no journal entries, and letters only to his mother and Robbie. Before long, he'd forgotten the old football scores again, and could only recall a few of the more famous scripture verses. He would stare at the ceiling for hours, mumbling over and over, "Jesus, I'm losing my mind." The visitor's room at Polunsky is a large, open area with plenty of tables and chairs and vending machines along the walls. In the center, there's a long row of booths, all divided by glass. The inmates sit on one side, their visitors on the other, and all conversations are by phone. Behind the inmates, guards are always looming, watching. To one side, there are three booths used for attorney visits. They, too, are divided by glass, and all consultations are by phone. In the early years, Dante was thrilled at the sight of Robbie Flack sitting at the narrow counter on the other side of the glass. Robbie was his lawyer, his friend, his fierce defender, and Robbie was the man who would right this incredible wrong. Robbie was fighting hard and loud and threatening hellfire for those who were mistreating his client. So many of the condemned had bad lawyers on the outside, or no lawyers at all. Their appeals had run, the system was finished with them. No one out there was advocating on their behalf. But Dante had Mr. Robbie Flack, and he knew at some moment in each day his lawyer was thinking about him and scheming a new way to get him out. But after 8 years on death row, Dante had lost hope. He had not lost faith in Robbie. He'd simply realized that the Texas systems were much more powerful than one lawyer. Absent a miracle, this wrong would run its course. Robbie had explained that they would file motions until the very end, but he was also realistic. They spoke through the phone, each happy to see the other. Robbie brought greetings from the entire Drum family. He visited their home the night before and gave all the details. Dante listened with a smile but said little. His conversational skills had deteriorated along with everything else. Physically, he was a skinny, stooped, aging man of 27. Mentally, he was a mess. He could not keep up with time, never knew if it was night or day, often skipped meals, showers, and his daily hour of recreation. He refused to say a word to the guards and often had trouble following their most basic commands. They were somewhat sympathetic because they knew he was not a threat. He sometimes slept 18 to 20 hours a day, and when he wasn't asleep, he was unable to do anything. He'd not exercised in years. He never read and managed to write a letter or two each week, but only to his family and Robbie. The letters were short, often incoherent, and filled with misspelled words and glaring grammatical errors. The writing was so sloppy that it was disheartening. A letter from Dante was not a pleasant envelope to open. Dr. Christy Hines had read and analyzed hundreds of letters he'd written during his 8 years on death row. She'd already formed the opinion that the solitary confinement had driven him far from reality. He was depressed, lethargic, delusional, paranoid, schizophrenic, and suicidal. He was hearing voices, those of his late father and his high school football coach. In layman's terms, his brain had shut down. He was insane. After a few minutes of summarizing where they were with the last-minute appeals and covering the events scheduled for the next 2 days, Robbie introduced Dr. Hines. She took the seat and the phone and said hello. Robbie stood close behind her with a legal pad and pen. For over an hour, she asked questions about his daily routine, his habits, dreams, thoughts, desires, and feelings about death. He surprised her by saying that 213 men had been executed while he had been on death row. Robbie confirmed the number to be accurate. But there were no more surprises, no more specifics. She quizzed him at length about the reasons he was there and why he was to be executed. He did not know, did not understand why they were doing this to him. Yes, he was certain that he was about to be executed. Just look at the other 213. 1 hour was enough for Dr. Hines. She handed the phone back to Robbie, who sat down and began talking about the details for Thursday. He told Dante that his mother was determined to watch the execution, and this upset him. He began crying and finally put the phone down to wipe his face. He refused to pick it up, and when he stopped crying, he locked his arms across his chest and stared at the floor. Finally, he stood and walked to the door behind him. The rest of the team waited outside in the van, a guard nearby, casually watching them. When Robbie and Dr. Hines returned to the van, Aaron waved at the guard and drove away. They stopped at a pizza place on the edge of town and had a quick lunch. They had just settled back in the van and were leaving Livingston when the phone rang. It was Fred Pryor. Joey Gamble had called and wanted to meet for a drink after work. Chapter 11. In a normal week, Reverend Schroeder would spend most of Tuesday afternoon locked in his office with the phones on hold as he searched for his next sermon's topic. He looked at current events, thought about the needs of his flock, prayed a lot, and if nothing happened, would go to the files and look at old sermons. When the idea finally hit, he would write a quick outline and then begin the full text. At that point, the pressure was off, and he could practice and rehearse until Sunday. Few things felt worse, though, than waking up on Wednesday morning with no idea what he would say on Sunday. But with Travis Boyette on his mind, he could concentrate on nothing else. He took a long nap after lunch Tuesday and felt thick-headed, almost groggy when it was over. Dana had left the office to tend to the children, and Keith puttered around the church, unable to do anything productive. He finally left. He thought about driving to the hospital and checking on Boyette, in hopes that perhaps the tumor had shifted and the man had changed his mind. But that was unlikely. While Dana cooked dinner and the boys were busy with homework, Keith found solitude in the garage. His latest project was to organize it, paint it, and then plan to keep it shipshape forever. He usually enjoyed the mindless cleaning, but Boyette managed to ruin even that. After half an hour, he gave up and took his laptop to their bedroom and locked the door. The Drum website was like a magnet, a thick, juicy novel with so much he had not yet read. The Coffee Grail Scandal. The prosecution of Dante Drum was led by Paul Coffey, the district attorney for Sloan and Chester County. The presiding judge at Dante's trial was Vivian Grail. Both Coffey and Grail were elected officials. At the time of the trial, Coffey had been in office for 13 years. Grail had been on the bench for 5. Coffey was married to his wife, Sarah, and they had, and still have, 3 children. Grail was married to her husband, Frank, and they had, and still have, 2 children. The Coffeys are now divorced, as are the Grails. The only significant motion filed by the defense that was granted by Judge Grail was a request to change the venue of the trial. Given its sensational nature and the extensive coverage in the media, a fair trial was impossible in Sloan. Attorneys for Dante wanted to move it far away, and they suggested either Amarillo or Lubbock, each about 500 miles from Sloan. Judge Grail granted the request. Experts agree that she really had no choice. To have the trial in Sloan would have been to create certain reversible error, and she decided to hold it in Paris, Texas. The courthouse in Paris is exactly 49 miles from the courthouse in Sloan. After the conviction, attorneys for Dante argued vehemently on appeal that trying the case in Paris was no different from trying it in Sloan. Indeed, during the jury selection process, over half of the prospective jurors admitted they had heard something about the case. Other than the change of venue, Judge Grail showed no patience with the defense. Her most crucial ruling was to allow Dante's coerced confession. Without it, the prosecution had no case, no evidence, nothing. The confession was their case. But other rulings were almost as damaging. The police and prosecutors used a favorite tactic when they produced a jailhouse snitch by the name of Ricky Stone. Stone was in jail on drug charges and agreed to cooperate with Detective Kerber and the Sloan police. He was placed in a cell with Dante Drum for 4 days, then removed. Dante never saw him again until the trial. Stone testified that Dante talked openly about the rape and murder of Nicole and said that he went crazy after she broke up with him. They'd been dating secretly for several months, they were in love, but she became frightened and worried that her wealthy father would cut off the money if he knew she was seeing a black guy. Stone testified that he had been promised nothing by the prosecutor in return for his testimony. 2 months after Dante was convicted, Stone pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor and walked out of jail. Stone had an extensive criminal record and zero credibility. He was a classic jailhouse snitch, fabricating testimony in return for a lighter sentence. Judge Grail allowed him to testify. Stone later recanted and said he'd been pressured by Detective Kerber and Paul Coffey to lie. Judge Grail also permitted testimony that had been discredited for many years in many jurisdictions. During the search for Nicole, the police used bloodhounds to sniff around for clues. The dogs were given a scent from Nicole's car and some articles in it, and turned loose. The trails led nowhere, that is, until Dante was arrested. The police then allowed the bloodhounds to sniff through the green Ford van owned by the Drum family. According to the dog's handler, the dogs became excited, agitated, and showed every sign of picking up Nicole's scent in the van. This unreliable testimony was first played out in a pretrial hearing. Attorneys for Dante were incredulous and demanded to know how they were supposed to cross-examine a bloodhound. Attorney Robbie Flack was so outraged that he called one of the dogs, a bloodhound named Yogi, a stupid son of a bitch. Judge Grail held him in contempt and fined him $100. Remarkably, the dog's principal handler was still allowed to testify at trial and stated to the jury that after 30 years of experience with bloodhounds, he was absolutely certain that Yogi had picked up Nicole's scent in the green van. He was eviscerated on cross-examination by Robbie Flack, who at one point demanded to have the dog brought to the courtroom, sworn in, and put in the witness chair. Judge Grail exhibited animosity toward the defense lawyers, especially Robbie Flack. She was much more agreeable with Paul Coffey. And with good reason. 6 years after the trial, it became known that the judge and the prosecutor were involved in a long-running illicit romance. The affair came to light when a disgruntled ex-secretary in Mr. Coffey's office filed a claim for sexual harassment and produced emails, phone records, and even phone recordings that revealed her ex-boss's involvement with Judge Grail. Lawsuits followed, as did divorces. Judge Grail resigned from the bench in disgrace and left Sloan while her divorce was pending. Paul Coffey was re-elected without opposition in 2006, but only after promising to quit when the term was over. Attorneys for Dante sought relief because of the obvious conflict of interest between the judge and the prosecutor. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said that while the affair was unfortunate and could possibly give the appearance of impropriety, it did not violate the defendant's right to a fair trial. Relief in the federal courts was just as elusive. In 2005, Paul Coffey filed a defamation suit against Robbie Flack for statements Flack made in an interview about Coffey's intimate involvement with his trial judge. Flack countersued Coffey for a myriad of offenses. The litigation is still pending. Hours later, when the lights were off and the house was quiet, Keith and Dana stared at the ceiling and debated whether they should go look for the sleeping pills. Both were exhausted, but sleep seemed impossible. They were tired of reading about the case, discussing it, tired of worrying about a young black man on death row whom they had never heard of until the day before, and they were especially frustrated with the newest person in their lives, one Travis Boyette. Keith was certain he was telling the truth. Dana was leaning that way, but was still skeptical because of his disgusting criminal record. They were tired of arguing about it. If Boyette was telling the truth, could they be the only people in the world who knew for certain that Texas was about to execute the wrong man? If so, what could they do? How could they do anything if Boyette refused to admit the truth? And if he changed his mind and decided to admit the truth, what were they supposed to do about it? Sloan was 400 miles away, and they didn't know anyone there. Why should they? They'd never heard of the place until yesterday. The questions raged through the night, and the answers were nowhere to be found. They decided to watch the digital clock until midnight, and if still awake, go find the pills. At 11:04 p.m., the phone rang and startled them. Dana hit a light switch. The caller ID read, St. Fran Hospital. "It's him," she said. Keith picked up the receiver and said,
"Hello?" "Sorry to call so late, Pastor," Boyette said in a low, strained voice. "It's okay, Travis. We were not asleep. How's your cute little wife?"
"Fine. Look, Travis, I'm sure you're calling for a reason."
"Yeah, sorry, Pastor. I really want to see the girl again, you know what I mean?"
Keith held the receiver so Dana could squeeze in with her left ear. He did not want to repeat everything afterward.
"I'm not sure what you mean, Travis," he said. "The girl. Nicole, my little Nikki. I'm not long for this world, Pastor. I'm still in the hospital, an IV in my arm, all kinds of dope in my blood, and the doctors are telling me that it won't be long. I'm half dead now, Pastor, and I don't like the thought of kicking the bucket without one last visit with Nikki. She's been dead for 9 years." "No shit. I was there, remember? It was awful. What I did to her was just awful. And I've apologized before several times, face to face. But I gotta go again. Tell her just once more how sorry I am about what happened. You know what I mean, Pastor?"
"No, Travis, I have no idea what you mean."
"She's still there, okay? She's where I left her."
"You said you probably couldn't find her now." There was a long pause as Travis seemed to recall this.
"I know where she is," he said.
"Great, Travis. Then go find her. Go dig her up and look at her bones and tell her you're sorry. Then what? You'll feel better about yourself? Meanwhile, an innocent man gets the needle for your crime."
"I have an idea, Travis.
After you tell Nicole you're sorry one last time, why don't you go to Sloan and stop by the cemetery, find Dante's grave, and tell him you're sorry, too."
Dana turned and frowned at her husband. Travis took another pause and then said,
"I don't want that boy to die, Pastor."
"That's really hard to believe, Travis."